Good afternoon, everybody. Shul Plotzer coming at you live. It's book club class, Monday afternoon, February 27 of the year 23. We're studying and reading the book, The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Volume 1. Before I go any further, mazel tov to my brother, Morty Plotzer, and his wife, Sarah, on the engagement of their daughter, Adina, to a young man, also from Elizabeth, Hillside, that area, Ashtrav, a young man by the name of Ashtrav, and we wish them all, both families, lots of mazel, bracha, and atzlacha. Very exciting to have a chassan and a family coming up. Certainly wonderful, exciting stuff. I look forward to wonderful, a beautiful simcha. Okay, we are in page 51 of the book, and we are going to continue. I just was thinking about commenting upon how Rabbi Soloveitchik weighed in. Maybe it's going to come up. Weighed in on the Synagogue Council of America. Yeah, we did that already. The RCA continued its association with the Synagogue Council during the ensuing decades, and then the Synagogue Council ceased its activities in 1994. The Synagogue Council of America was like Orthodox Conservative Reform denominations or the synagogues, and they would just like act as some sort of organization, as an umbrella projecting Jewish interests outside. Not necessarily talking about internal stuff, but strictly talking, to the external world with one Jewish voice. That may have been possible 50 years ago. Not sure if today it could be. With the Reform and Conservative going woke completely and Orthodoxy going to the right and very politically and culturally conservative, there's very, very little chance that we could speak with one voice to the American people. At all events, according to haemsa.com, by Harry Marrows out in Chicago, he said that he is applauding Rabbi Moshe Hauer, the executive vice president of the Union of Orthodox Congregations, for reaching out and talking to Rabbi Rick Jacobs of the National Federation of Temples or something, the Reform Organization. And he felt that it's acceptable to do that. Now, years back, 11 Rosh Yeshivas forbade the Agudas Yisrael shuls from having anything whatsoever to do with the Synagogue Council of America. But the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America did not go along with that ban, and the RCA did not go along with that ban. So that might explain why, among many reasons, it could explain why modern Orthodox shuls, which are members of the OU, and whose rabbis are members of the RCA, not held in very high esteem by those who followed the 11 Rosh Yeshivas, who forbade any kind of involvement whatsoever in the Synagogue Council of America. Take a look at the article, that thread, and the comments thereto on Harry Merrill's blog, haemsa.blogspot.com. Fascinating reading. And the comments are also super interesting as well. Okay, let's continue on page 51, and let us get some traction here. Let's get some stuff done. I'm looking forward to doing a lot today. Here we go. Rabbi Soloveitchik represented the entire Jewish community as a member of the Advisory Committee on Humane Slaughter of the United States Department of Agriculture. That's back in 1958. The Rav's name was submitted by the Rabbinical Council for this position. He was also endorsed by the Synagogue Council, the American Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee, and the New York Board of Rabbis. As a member of the committee, Rabbi Soloveitchik was instrumental in designing new methods for the handling of livestock prior to Shechita. One device called a cradle was developed in Cincinnati. How about that? While another was designed in Toronto. By the way, I forgot to perhaps fully mention, we are Gulf Manor Synagogue, and we are the School of Jewish Studies of Gulf Manor Synagogue, and we are a member of the OU, and our rabbis for years were affiliated with, they were from Yeshiva University, and members of the RCA. Of course, I'm not sure about Rabbi Indisch, quite frankly, and Rabbi Landis might have been as well. I'm not sure about Rabbi Alt currently. I should look into that. At all events, one device called a cradle was developed in Cincinnati, while another was designed in Toronto. With the latter device, a hand lever raised the head and neck of the animal to a point at which it was ready to slaughter. Both these new restraining methods met with the halachic approval of the Rav and Rabbi Eliezer Silver, then a member of the Presidium of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis. The introduction of these new devices gradually diminished the opposition of humane societies to Jewish ritual slaughter methods. In these activities, the Rav was assisted by Rabbi Emanuel Holzer, the chairman of the Rabbinical Council's Shechita Committee. Holzer was also appointed chairman of the Synagogue Council's Religious Observance Committee to coordinate efforts to prevent restrictive legislation in the state legislatures. Over the ensuing decades, Holzer was to aid the Rav in many of his endeavors. Page 52. During the years after the Rav's arrival in the United States, the relationship of Torah Jewry and the Zionist movement gradually became the foremost issue on the agenda of Orthodoxy. The Rav provided guidance and direction for his disciples and devotees. Originally, the Rav was a member of the Agudath Israel of America, which was reconstituted in 1939. Although there had been earlier attempts to organize Agudath Israel in the United States, it was only then, with the influx of East European refugees, that the American branch took root. The Rav was soon to become the chairman of its National Executive Committee and a member of the newly formed American Council of Torah Sages. At the 1940 convention, Rabbi Soloveitchik delivered the hesped from Rabbi Chaim Moshe Grudzinski of Vilna, who had passed away on August 9, 1940. The latter had been a leading Talmudic scholar, respondent, and political leader of Lithuanian Orthodox Jewry. In his eulogy, the Rav vividly portrayed the total leadership provided by the late Rabbi of Vilna against the background of the unprecedented tribulations and dissolution of the European Jewish community. This hesped was later published under the title Nosei Hatzitzva Choshen, the bearers of the high priest's gold plate and breastplate. Although the Rav later left the Agudath Israel, he continued to support the Chinuch Atzmai independent school system, which Agudath Israel had established in Israel. The Rav delivered the keynote address at the Chinuch Atzmai dinner on January 11, 1956, at the invitation of Rabbi Aaron Cutler, who appointed him honorary chairman. Rabbi Aaron, as he was popularly known, was the senior American Rosh Hashiva and the founder of the Beis Medrash Gavoa in Lakewood, New Jersey, in 1943. By the way, Rabbi Aaron Cutler was born in 1892 and passed in 1962. Top of page 53. Rabbi Cutler was also the driving spirit in the American branch of the Agudath Israel. In his address for the Chinuch Atzmai, the Rav exclaimed, "Rav Aaron, the great Rosh Hashiva, has no cold light in him. It is hot. It kindles. And as you approach him, you in turn become enkindled. And if there is one single individual who has warmed me towards Chinuch Atzmai, it is the senior Rosh Hashiva, Rav Aaron, to whom I pay homage." The Rav became a stalwart member of the Mizrahi movement as the tragedy of the destruction of European Jewry became known. From 1946 until his death, he served as the honorary president of the RZA, the Religious Zionists of America, formerly Mizrahi. On Israel Independence Day in 1956, Rabbi Soloveitchik delivered the main address at a public convocation at Yeshiva University. The main address, what is with me? He wasn't publishing his address where he lived. Again, on Israel Independence Day in Yom HaTzmaut 1956, Rabbi Soloveitchik delivered the main address at a public convocation at YU, later published under the title Kol Dodi Dofik, It is the Voice of My Beloved That Knocks. This essay gained renown as a seminal statement of religious Zionism in the post-Holocaust era. Delivered in Yiddish and published in Hebrew, the essay was later translated into English and Russian. Utilizing the metaphor of the Song of Songs, the Rav spoke about the six knocks of the Almighty on the door of the Jewish people when the state of Israel was born. Kol dodi dofek. Hark, my beloved knocks. The voice of my beloved is knocking. See Song of Songs, chapter 5, pasuk 2. First, the knock of the beloved was heard in the political arena. The establishment of the state of Israel, in a political sense, was an almost supernatural occurrence. Both Russia and the Western countries jointly supported the establishment of the state. This was perhaps the only proposal on which East and West were united during this period. Remember, this is right after World War II, and the Soviet Union reverted back to being, and if you will, an enemy of the West. Obviously, in 1917, when the Russian Revolution took place, I don't really know exactly how much opposition or how much hatred was being thrown at the West from the nascent Soviet Union. I'm just not aware of it. And for 30 years, from 1917 until, you know, almost the state of Israel being founded, 1947, Israel was founded in 1948, of course. So for those 30 years, you know, how much was Russia hating the West? They were together with the West in the Second World War. They were allies. It was only after the war was concluded, 1945, that the Soviet Union became an implacable foe of the Western world, of America and its allies. And yet here we are. Here we see both the Soviet Union and the United States both voting for the creation of the State of Israel. That really, truly is remarkable. And what does the Satmar Rav say about that? I mean, when he talks about the three shvuas, that you can't go against the wishes of the world, well, what about the United Nations vote? They voted for the State of Israel to be founded. Indeed, two world-class enemies on the world stage, Cold War enemies, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, both voted for the State of Israel to be founded, to be allowed to be founded. It's incredible. So in what way, and so you're either with the Western bloc following the U.S., or you're with the Soviet Union, but both those countries, which led blocs, both those countries were in favor of the State of Israel being formed. Very few countries were opposed to it, and it won in the United Nations on a vote. So where is it still the case that the Shvua, as discussed in the Gemara and Ksuvos, the three Shvuas, that the State of Israel somehow went against the nations of the world when England was in favor of it, and then, of course, it backed off, but during the Balfour Declaration, they're very in favor of it. Now, I know the Arab countries are opposed to it, but they're opposed to women driving. I mean, what do you want from them? I mean, they're as backwards as you can get. I mean, I don't understand. Can anybody actually, with a straight face, say, well, you know, the Arab countries are opposed to the State of Israel, so therefore we can't do anything because they're the world. They're not the world. I mean, there are 300-400 million of them, and they have a lot of oil, but they're not the majority population, and they're not the majority in the United Nations. So I'm not sure what to make of the Satmar Rav's argument. I just don't. I mean, maybe some Satmar will explain it to me. But when you show them that the United Nations voted on behalf of the State of Israel being founded, what's the answer to that? I don't know. But we continue. Second, what else of the knocking on the door by the Almighty? The knocking of the beloved can be discerned on the battlefield. The small Israeli army of 1948 defeated the vastly larger armies of the many Arab countries. Certainly that's the case. And if you light candles to commemorate a miracle, Hanukkah time, about how the yeshiva guys and the Kohanim of the Beis Hamikdash fought up against, you know, fought the Syrian Greeks, it's like Lakewood going up against the United States Marine Corps and winning. Nobody would give them any odds. I mean, that'd be crazy. I mean, it's a million to one they're going to win. It's grand nuttiness. If there they are winning the war, kicking out the U.S. Marine Corps and establishing, you know, cleaning up the Beis Hamikdash and establishing a Jewish hegemony again. So how do you account for that? That, I mean, if you think there was a miracle in Hanukkah time, how is this less a miracle? Should we lighting candles? I don't get it. Third, the knock of the beloved was heard on the theological level. This is very important, by the way. For those of us who actually follow this Mishigas, and I do, the Catholic Church, which has, you know, 2.2 billion people in the world, which is by any stretch, you know, by any standard, it's a lot of people. And for centuries and centuries, they argued that the Jews were cursed by God because we rejected Jesus as the Messiah, never going to go back to Israel. God hates our guts. He leaves us alone because he wants to show the world what happens when you reject Jesus. So for centuries, they went out of their way, the Catholic Church, to hurt us, to show, you see, you're down and miserable and economically, you're repressed. So the answer is, if you just leave us alone, maybe you wouldn't be like that. But no, the Catholic Church had to do what it had to do. And then when Herzl went to speak to the Pope, late 1800s, early 1900s, the Pope rebuffed him and said, let me get this straight. You're asking me to give you a blessing that that I should bless a Jewish movement to reclaim the state of Israel and Jews should go back and live there? I'm not giving you such a blessing. I'm not going to bless that. Says, okay, Holy Father, thanks a lot. And 40 years later, nobody needed it because 50 years later, because thank God the state of Israel was founded against Catholic opposition. And for many, many years, the Catholics weren't into it. I remember, interviewing a woman who was representing the Holy See in the United Nations. I went to NYU undergraduate, and I figured I'd write something for a freshman composition. I'll write about the Catholic Church's opposition to the state of Israel, or what could it be based on? Well, religion, yeah. And then I interviewed her. I said, what are the reasons why that you guys don't recognize the state of Israel? So she said, well, it's because Israel does not have any defined borders. I said, wait, Israel does not have any defined borders? You mean the border with Transjordan? Is that what you mean? Yeah. I said, do you recognize Transjordan? Yes. Well, how could you do that? If Transjordan has a border issue with Israel, you're not sure where the border is. And the Six-Day War saw Israel taking over chunks of what used to be Jordanian territory and Judean Samaria. It took over Syria, the Golan Heights. It took over the Sinai Peninsula. But how could you recognize Jordan? It has the same exact problem as Israel does. You recognize Jordan, but you don't recognize Israel? Why is that? Not a good answer. So what about Syria? Why don't you recognize Israel? Because of the Syria border with the Golan? Well, do you recognize Syria? Yeah, well, how could you do that? If Syria has a border issue with Israel, Israel's got a border issue with Syria. You recognize one, not the other? Why? No good answer for that. So these jokers are just clowns, really. The Vatican, they've proven themselves time and again to be clowns. Wearing long, long dresses. What are you going to do with them? I recommend they all get married and find women to love, get married and raise children. That's what I recommend they do, but they're not going to listen to me. They won't listen to God. God said so. They won't listen to him. What do you want for my life? Okay, so again, the third knocking was the hurt on the theological level. He writes, the stand of Christian theologians. This is only a Catholic thing. This is not a Protestant thing. Only the Catholics are opposed to Israel, Jewish people going back to Israel. The Protestants see that very much in the Bible, in the Hebrew prophets. They see a return of the Jews to the land of Israel. Then they think Jesus is going to come back in a second coming. But that's a Protestant belief that, yes, of course, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 talk about the Jews returning to Israel. But the Catholic Church doesn't read it like that. They have some kind of crazy, non-literal approach, which they, they get in front of a mirror and they say, isn't this the way we should read it? Yeah, this is the way we should read it. All those Protestants have no idea what they're doing. Yeah, the Protestants are completely 100% correct over here, 101% correct. Yes, the Jews are coming back to Israel, and you see it with your own eyes in front of you. The Catholic Church didn't want to see it for a few years, then they realized this is ridiculous. It's a country in the Middle East, and we don't recognize its existence. Meanwhile, there are Catholics living in the land of Israel. They need us to represent them, and we don't recognize the state in which they're living. This is nuts. I mean, there are Catholics in Jerusalem, Nazareth, Bethlehem, in the old city of Yerushalayim. What are you going to do with them? You have to be able to have a chat with the ones who are in political power in the land of Israel, which is of course the state of Israel. Anyway. The stand of, I'm going to fix this, Catholic theologians that God had deprived the Jewish people of its right to the land of Israel was publicly refuted by the establishment of Israel. Top page 54. Fourth, the beloved is knocking on the hearts of the perplexed and assimilated Jewish youth. The very fact that Israel is always in the news has awakened latent Jewish feelings among the masses, and in particular, among Jewish young people. The fifth knock of the beloved is that divine providence, for the first time in the history of our exile, has shown our enemies that Jewish blood is not free for the taking. It's not Hefka. Quote, the honor of every community, like the honor of every individual, is a function of its ability to defend its existence and honor. A people that cannot ensure its own freedom and security is not truly independent. End quote. That was a Soloveitchik. The state of Israel has enabled its citizens, with the help of God, to defend themselves. Finally, the sixth knock was heard when the gates of Israel were opened to all Jews, following the restrictive immigration policies of the British mandate. The state of Israel now eagerly welcomes every Jew who seeks lodging in the Holy Land. Jews can now direct their steps unto Zion, and she, like a compassionate mother, will gather in her children. So I'm going to read, we're going to study together, Kol Do Di Do Fake, God willing, when we complete volume one and or volume two. Then we'll do Kol Do Di Do Fake, The Voice of My Beloved is Knocking. Then we're going to see some other essays. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes very, very deeply in Halachic Man and Lonely Man of Faith. Not sure if that's going to be 101% appropriate, because he's going to get into some deep philosophical stuff on page one. Got to have a PhD in philosophy to follow him. But we could see, potentially, at the Chayanim of Akesh, My Brethren I Do Seek. We'll see that, hopefully. Everything in translation. And hopefully everything in good time. Let's keep going. Page 54, in the middle. In a talk he... Now, this is real... People, this is really important, so listen up. Okay? Listen up, and I have something else to add to it. It's so great. Rabbi, you'll see. One piece of... Here we go. Page 54. In a talk he gave to the annual conference of the American Mizrahi, Hapoel HaMizrahi, in the mid-1950s, Rabbi Soloveitchik explained why he had abandoned the Agudath of Israel outlook and espoused that of the Mizrahi. Later published under the title, quote, And Joseph Dreamt a Dream, Rabbi Soloveitchik equated the Mizrahi viewpoint with the actions of the biblical Joseph and the Agudath of Israel with Yosef's brothers. Joseph sought to prepare his brethren for the new life that they would encounter in Egypt. The brothers did not understand Yosef, because they looked upon the future as a continuation of the present. They understood their problems within the framework of their life in Canaan, the land of their father's wanderings. Similarly, the Mizrahi was concerned with building the future of Torah in the land of Israel, whereas the good of Israel was primarily focused upon the continuity of Jewish life in its current East European centers. The Holocaust convinced the Rav that the Mizrahi position was correct. Just as Yosef paved the way for the next chapter of Jewish endeavor in Egypt, the Mizrahi enabled the state of Israel to become the core center of Torah life after the destruction of East European Jewry. Page 55. The Rav declared, quote, I would like to ask a simple question. What would the yeshivot and Torah scholars rescued from the Holocaust, these burning embers taken from the fire, have done if the Joseph of 1902, the year the Mizrahi was founded, had not trod a path for them in the land of Israel? It was only the Mizrahi that made possible the transplanting of the Tree of Life of Lithuania and other lands in the Holy Land. End quote. The Rebbe continually urged the leaders of Israel's Mizrahi political party to stress religious education and not only religious legislation. He felt that more widespread observance of Torah would be achieved through education and not as a result of formal legislation resulting from political influence. Regarding the dispute over territorial compromises, which became more acute following the Six-Day War, the Rebbe took the position that to save Jewish life, such concessions would be possible. Rebbe Soloveitchik held that decisions in such matters should be made by the military and political leaders of the State of Israel. For questions of this kind, they would have the same status as the expert or medical doctor who determines whether a sick person may be fed on Yom Kippur. It's now that I want to read you an article from HaMizrahi magazine called Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik Leaves the Good of Israel for Mizrahi. This is in the HaMizrahi magazine detailing 100 years of Mizrahi history. So I've got pages 24 and 25. Can we read this to you? For the first time in the annals of our exile, this is Rabbi Soloveitchik. Kol Dodi Dofek in Yom HaAtzmaut 1956. We just read about it. Here's Rabbi Soloveitchik in his own words. For the first time in the annals of our exile, divine providence has amazed our enemies with the astounding discovery that Jewish blood is not cheap. If we want to courageously defend our continued national and historical existence, the Torah has always taught that a man is permitted, indeed has a sacred obligation, to defend himself. Public and private honor is dependent upon the possibility of defending one's life and one's honor. A people that cannot defend its freedom and tranquility is neither free nor independent. The third of the phrases of divine redemption is, "And I shall redeem you with an outstretched hand and with great judgments." Exodus 6, verse 6. Thank God we have lived to see the day when, with the help of God, Jews have it within their power to defend themselves. Let us not forget that the poison of Hitlerite antisemitism, which made Jews fair game to all, still permeates this generation, which looked with equanimity upon the horrible scene of the suffocation of millions in gas chambers as a normal event that need not be challenged. The antidote for this venom that poisoned minds and dulled hearts is the readiness of the State of Israel to defend the lives of its citizens. Listen, my beloved Knox. Those are the words of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Here is a piece from Rabbi Soloveitchik, a book by Rabbi Soloveitchik, The Rub Speaks, five addresses on Israel, history, and the Jewish people. Judaica Press, the year 2002. In 1935, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik submitted his candidacy to become the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv as a representative of Agudath Israel. Less than a decade later, in 1944, Rabbi Soloveitchik was the chairman of the Central Committee of the Religious Zionists of America. Rabbi Soloveitchik's shift in allegiance from Agudath Israel to Mizrahi resulted from a frank and painful reevaluation of his philosophy in response to the Holocaust. Witnessing the destruction of European Jewry, Rabbi Soloveitchik came to believe that Mizrahi's activist approach to building a Jewish future in the land of Israel had saved Judaism and the Jewish people from extinction. In a 1962 address to the Religious Zionists of America, Rabbi Soloveitchik explained, quote, "I was not born into a Zionist household. My parents' ancestors, my father's house, my teachers and colleagues were far from the Mizrahi religious Zionists. My links with Mizrahi grew gradually. I had my doubts about the validity of the Mizrahi approach. I built an altar upon which I sacrificed sleepless nights, doubts, and reservations. Regardless, the years of the Hitlerian Holocaust, the establishment of the State of Israel, and the accomplishments of the Mizrahi in the land of Israel convinced me of the correctness of our movement's path. The altar still stands today, with smoke rising from the sacrifice upon it. Jews like me are required to sacrifice on this altar their peace of mind, as well as their social relationships and friendships. Wow. How about that? A couple of thoughts. A tree was not born into a Zionist household. But when he says, my father's house, my teachers and colleagues, far from the Mizrahi religious Zionists. Well, wait a second. Didn't Rav Moshe Soloveitchik take the position at the Tach Kamoni, like a religious institution in Warsaw? And that was like a training institute to raise teachers and maybe rabbis. And that was a Mizrahi-oriented school. His father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, took that position at the Tach Kamoni. Didn't we read that? So I'm not sure. I mean, his own father took a position working for and with Mizrachis. So, I'm not sure exactly what we're going to glean from the idea that when he says that he had nothing at all to do with the Mizrahi, his own father did. His own father became a yeshiva at Yeshiva University. Well, maybe then it was simply Rabbeinu Yitzchak Chanan Yeshiva. It was soon going to eventually turn into Yeshiva College. So I was going to tell you that became, that became a more, liberal, slightly, left leaning institution compared to Haredi yeshivas. Here, back on page 25, we read, in 1920, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik accepted a position as head of the Talmud department of the recently organized Tach Kamoni Rabbinical Seminary in Warsaw. This school represented a new approach to Torah education. Tach Kamoni embarked on a new rabbinic course of study, which stressed both Talmudic and secular education. How about that? Okay. It seems to be all we have about the Tach Kamoni, that it has a new rabbinic course of study, both Talmud and secular education. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik became the head of the Talmud department. We continue with the article about Rabbi Soloveitchik leaving Agudat Israel for Mizrahi. And here is Rabbi Herschel Schechter being interviewed by Avi Borgen. An interview with Rabbi Herschel Schechter. Last month, Avi Borgen asked Rabbi Herschel Schechter, Rosh Yeshiva, Yeshiva University's Rabbinical Chanan Theological Seminary, to reflect on Rabbi Soloveitchik's move to Mizrahi. Avi Borgen asks, why did Rabbi Soloveitchik become an activist in the Mizrahi movement? Answers Rabbi Herschel Schechter, who's one of the premier Talmidim of Rabbi Soloveitchik. The Rav said that he felt the Aguda had made a major mistake by not encouraging European Jewry to move to Eretz Israel before the war. So many lives could have been saved from the Holocaust if more Jews had gone to Eretz Israel. But the Rebbe also disagreed with the approach of Agudat Israel after the State of Israel was established. Many Rebbeinim believed that it was Yehoreg Val Yavar, that one must give up his life before joining the coalition government in the State of Israel. But Rabbi Soloveitchik said that even when the government is doing anti-religious things, and in the early years, the government was very anti-religious, you have to choose the lesser of the two evils and join the coalition government. You have to act. You have to be involved to make a difference. Years later, Rabbi Elazar Shach took the same position as the Rav and said that the Haredi community must join the coalition government. When his position became public, he was attacked by Rabbi Moshe Sternbach, then a young whippersnapper, who quoted great rabbis from earlier generations, who said it is forbidden to join the coalition government. So Rabbi Shach wrote a letter to his relative, Rabbi Schneer Kuppler, in America, and said they should hang this letter up in all the yeshivot in America. In this letter, Rabbi Shach explained why he felt that the Haredi community had to join the coalition, for we have a tradition from our Rabbanim that we must try to choose the lesser of two evils. The Gemara in Erevin explains this principle. Rabbi Shach ultimately reached the same conclusion as Rabbi Soloveitchik. Many years later, after the Rav, that we have to be involved to be willing to join the government and get things accomplished. So I want to make sure I read that correctly. But Reshach ultimately reached the same conclusion as Rabbi Soloveitchik many years later after the Rav, that we have to be involved, be willing to join the government, and get things accomplished. Avi Borgen asks, over the years, Rabbi Soloveitchik occasionally disagreed strongly with some of Mizrahi's positions. How did he feel about the movement in his later years? Rabbi Yosef Schechter answers, the Rav would sometimes condemn the government for taking a certain stand and praise Mizrahi for standing up to the government. And sometimes he would strongly disagree with Mizrahi when he felt they took the wrong position. After one such disagreement, someone asked the Rav if he was leaving Mizrahi. And so Soloveitchik responded, I didn't say I'm quitting Mizrahi. A husband and wife never have disagreements. I don't get divorced every time I have a disagreement with my spouse. Yes, I disagree with the position the party took in the Knesset, but I'm not getting divorced from Mizrahi. The Rav was an independent thinker, but he fundamentally agreed with the Mizrahi approach. How about that? We continue. The Rav's middle page 55. The Rav's identification with religious Zionism struck a responsive chord among his disciples. Hundreds of his students and their families made aliyah, finding encouragement and support in the Rav's theological stance regarding the state of Israel. Yet the Rav himself was never to visit Israel again after his 1935 journey. Years later, following the death of Chief Rabbi Isaac Herzog in 1959, Rabbi Soloveitchik declined to be a candidate to succeed him as the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the state of Israel. At that juncture, the Rav's election was assured, for he enjoyed the backing of a wide spectrum of the Israeli rabbinate and lay leaders. This support was led by the venerable Rabbi Reuben Katz, who lived from 1880 to 1963, the chief rabbi of Petah Tikva. The Rav later explained his position, top page 56, quote, one of the reasons why I did not accept the post of chief rabbi of Israel, and the offer was made to me several times, was that I was afraid to be an officer of the state. A rabbinate linked up with the state cannot be completely free. I admire the rabbis in Israel for their courage in standing up for the problems there and displaying an almost superhuman heroism. However, the mere fact that from time to time halachic problems are discussed as political issues at cabinet meetings is an infringement on the sovereignty of the rabbinate. End quote. The Rav's negative decision was also influenced by the extent to which he felt at home in the United States by this time. He was totally fulfilled as the Rebbe, teacher, and leader of Westernized Torah Jewry. Rabbi Soloveitchik had gradually taken his place as the unchallenged leader of the popularly named modern Orthodox movement in North America. An article describing Orthodoxy in America in 1965 said of the Rav, quote, RCA looks for spiritual and, more recently, political leadership to Rabbi Soloveitchik, known affectionately to his followers as the Rav. In Sephardi you say Rav. One can almost distinguish a Jew's religious position by the manner in which he refers to Soloveitchik. The non-Orthodox are likely to call him Rabbi Soloveitchik. The RCA modern Orthodox like call him the Rav. His own students, Rebbe. And the right wing, we call him JB. And the right wing, JB, for the first two initials of his name. That's exactly right. If you go among the Yeshiva Shechever, they'll refer to him as JB. End quote. And the quote ends with, and the right wing, JB, for the first two initials of his name. Nevertheless, Rabbi Soloveitchik was never totally at home in the milieu of American modern Orthodoxy. He felt that it lacked a deep emotional foundation and self-effacing commitment. In his view, quote, modern Orthodoxy lacks the wings to soar to the heavens and is bereft of roots to truly penetrate the depth of religious experience, end quote. And indeed, you'll find, as I just did, a video of none other than Rabbi Soloveitchik on YouTube where he says that and more. Talks about his students. who are some of whom are great Talmudists, Lamdanim, but so they'd be good even in Yerushalayim. But he does take the task of the movement. It's true. Might have to see that essay as well. Notwithstanding, we continue, bottom page 56, notwithstanding, it was in the modern Orthodox world that the Rav's leadership was widely accepted. While the Rav's brilliant scholarship was acknowledged in all Torah circles, his main influence on the masses was through his students and the rabbis who followed his teachings. Top page 57. In addition, his public lectures and discourses enabled wider audiences to be in closer contact with the master. As a Talmudic and halakhic expositor, the Rav possessed unusual dexterity in explaining difficult technical problems. He was also a remarkable orator in his native Yiddish, and his audiences would rejoice or cry with him as he evolved his theological and homiletical portraits. The Rav likewise was an effective speaker in English and Hebrew. The annual halachic and agadic discourse, which Rabbi Soloveitchik delivered at Yeshiva University on the anniversary of his father's death, attracted thousands of listeners. These Yahrzeit drashot often lasted from 4 to 5 consecutive hours. They were regarded as the major yearly academic event for American Orthodoxy. A Yeshiva University student who attended a Yahrzeit drasha in the 1950s wrote, quote, "It is the evening of the third of Shvat, the Yahrzeit of the Rav's father, Rav Moshe Zatzal. And we are in Lampert Auditorium at Yeshiva University awaiting the arrival of the Rav to deliver his annual Yahrzeit shiur. Some of us have been waiting for a few hours, having come early to obtain seats as close as possible to the Rav. The auditorium is now packed and overflowing. Suddenly, as if an electric current has run through the room, the entire audience as one rises. The Rav has arrived. Sitting in front, we do not immediately see the Rav, for he enters from the rear. And we must traverse the entire length of the auditorium to reach us. Everyone is standing, blocking our view, yet the feeling of his presence pervades the room. Finally, the Rav emerges from the crowd, walking briskly, manuscript in hand, steps onto the stage, and sits down behind an empty table to begin the shiur. Then the journey starts. The Rav, usually focusing on one or more halachot of Rambam, takes off one question after another that reflect obvious difficulties in the halacha. At least they are obvious after the Rav sets them out in his clear, lucid, and inimitable manner of exposition. Then, after developing each of his questions, superlative pedagogue that he is, he reviews in summary form all of them to assure that we understand what the problems are that will now be clarified. Top page 58. That phrase of the shiur concluded, the Rav goes on to develop a concept, the chiddush of the shiur, traversing a plethora of passages in the Talmud, commentaries, mostly Rishonim, Midrashim, and others. We watch, listen, and many of us avidly write notes, trying to keep up with the Rav's rapid-fire delivery as he lays out the chiddush, brick by brick by brick, reconciling all the varied and seemingly contradictory texts. Now that the foundation has been set and the text reconciliation completed, the Rav returns to the original series of questions. Each is repeated and then almost summarily disposed of through application of the chiddush, one after the other. It is more than 2 hours later and the circuit has been completed. The first portion of the shiur is concluded. The Rav now turns to the agadic portion of the shiur, usually with a prefatory, albeit rhetorical question. Evilt nach, you want more? And of course he addresses, a grammatical point, I'll let it go. Evilt nach, you want more? The audience responds with a resounding yes, as the Rav embarks on another two-hour tour de force in his beautiful poetic Yiddish. We sit there entranced, swallowing every word. It is much more difficult now to take notes. In this portion of the shiur, we are overwhelmed. not only by the ideas and concepts being presented, but also by the beauty of the language, the choice and combination of words and phrases, the sheer poetry of the presentation, the masterful delivery, and of course, the absolute brilliance of the speakers. We sit entranced. The Shear is entering the fifth hour. Finally, it's over. It takes us a while to return to reality, but perforce, we have no choice. It was an unforgettable experience, one that we will carry with us for the rest of our lives. We will relate this special privilege we lived through to our children and grandchildren, but we must acknowledge how ill-equipped we are to convey the feeling, the mood, indeed, the exhilaration we felt at the time. One more little piece and call it a day. An American Orthodox rabbi who was not a Yeshiva University graduate described the Shear in the 1970s, quote, "It is a scene not likely to be repeated for a long time to come. A large assembly hall with several thousand people in attendance, young and old, men and women, learned rabbis and scholars, members of the academic community, Orthodox and non-Orthodox Jews. They listen intently. Tape recorders whir. Pencils take rapid notes. On the podium is a tall, lean, gray-bearded figure delivering a sheer lecture on the fine points of halacha and Jewish thought. His sheer is complex and subtle, but he will hold his diverse attention in thrall for 2 to 3 hours. How about that, my friends? How about that, Rabbi Soloveitchik holding his audience in thrall for so long? I'm sure he did that. I'm loving seeing him on video. I had never met the man in person, had no idea what his voice sounds like. So now we're putting together a name and a face and a voice. It's really fabulous. So go check Rabbi Soloveitchik out on YouTube. Everybody have a good day. Enjoy the rest of the day. Stay safe, productive, healthy, and wise. God willing, we're not going to meet again tomorrow night because it's the Zion Ba'adr dinner at Golf Meadows Synagogue. So therefore, I'm going to be attending that. And therefore, there will be no Tanakh class tomorrow night. As far as the one after that, it's going to be Purim Seudah. I presume we're not going to be able to do that either. So we're probably going to be off for the next 2 weeks from Tanakh. When we come back, God willing, we'll hit it hard with Isaiah 7:14 and the virgin or young woman who gave birth. We'll figure that out when we regroup. So no Tanakh class tomorrow night and no Tanakh class next week. Tomorrow night is Zion by the dinner. Next week is the Purim Seudah. There's just no way we can commit to giving a class at that hour. Wishing everybody a good rest of the day, good rest of the week, and see you, God willing, Wednesday morning for more Introduction to Talmud 101. Take care and be well, everybody. Bye for now.